So this is for you. Yes, you. The person that's been wanting to sign up for Breathe to Heal but still hasn't yet. Consider this your aggressive yet loving nudge towards something that's actually going to have a huge impact on the way you show up in the year ahead. And here is why. You will gain practical nervous system tools that you can actually lean on whenever you find yourself feeling dysregulated. The emotional release breathwork sessions will help you release what your body has been holding on to so you actually have some space for the good to come in. Through parts work and compassionate integration, you can get your protectors to calm the hell down so they are not running the show 24/7. Plus, this is 75 minutes each week that you're actually dedicating purely to your own healing journey. And just a reminder, if for some reason you can't make it to a session live, replays will be made available within 24 hours. So we are kicking off next week, January 13th, and we have 4 spots left. So if you are ready to make 2026 the year you actually put your nervous system first, grab your damn spot now. Head to adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal. So that is adultchildpodcast.com/breathe to heal. Breathe has an E at the end. Again, consider this your aggressive yet loving nudge. Well, welcome back to Shit Show Saturday. We have Shit Show Trevor. Welcome.
Thanks, Andrea. You're the first person I'm speaking to in 2026. Never would have predicted this would be the way to kick off the year. Yeah, happy New Year.
Happy Shit Show New Year. When did you join the community?
It was either March or April of this year, which is insane because it feels like yesterday, but that's at minimum 9 months ago.
And how long had you been listening to the podcast?
I was trying to track that down and do the math on that. I found you in the late summer of 2024, so maybe like 7 or 8 months.
How did you find the podcast?
I think it was you were a guest on another podcast. Somewhere I started pulling the thread when I hit like my like little child rock bottom. I think it was coming somewhere from maybe ADHD. Maybe a podcast talking about some similarities between symptoms of ADHD and
PTSD,
laundry list traits or something like that. And then, so maybe you were a guest somewhere, because when I hit 31, that's when I really tried to dial in on ADHD. And I think once I started to see the limitations of treating ADHD, I was like, oh, there's more to it than this. It's not exactly a matter of attention, you know?
When did you get diagnosed with ADHD?
Formally, after I turned 30, I was like, there's something here. But I've known for the longest time, probably since I was a teenager, that I was probably dealing with something.
Yeah. For me, I got diagnosed, I guess it was in maybe 2023. But I don't really think that I have ADHD. I think it's like CPTSD, and also I think it's the changes that my phone has made to my brain.
I totally understand. And this isn't, I'm not saying this to, how do I put it? I think that a lot of those symptoms are so similar. It's, even if the root cause isn't ADHD and it is CPTSD, I feel like the regimen I'm on for ADHD helps me, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, there's no point in me denying myself that, like, that care, even if I know it's CPTSD, because it's helpful to me, you know.
I think it's both a lot of the times.
Listening to a lot of podcasts about ADHD, often I feel like they're not exactly talking to me. Like, there's some of the expertise is valuable to me, but I also feel a lot of it doesn't speak to like core issues of attention. Like, it goes like, we can talk about procrastination, but procrastination that like goes deeper into like fear and things like that, and safety, you know, which I don't hear about as much. Yeah, it was nice to get that diagnosis at first because it helped me like figure out why things had gone the way they had gone. But then I still was clinging to the notion of, oh, I can improve or like get better than this or like, circumvent having it, you know, and that was painful to realize like, no, it doesn't really go away.
Where do your symptoms show up mostly?
They've changed throughout my life. Now, I'd say a lot of it has to do with memory and just externalizing information so that I can keep it. Because basically, if I put something in a drawer, I'm going to forget it's there physically and mentally. You know, just I can't be like, oh, I'll come back to this. I'll remember this. Procrastination, it's not as bad, but it's still around, just like avoidance of tasks. And just, I feel like I have that motor running to like do things 24/7, but like starting is a whole nother story, you know? So that can be kind of torture sometimes.
Tell me about it. I get that. I can't remember what the terminology of it. I came up with something, but it's like the, it's like you're ready to roll, but then it's like the moment you get started, just like that phrase.
Yeah, it's, and it's like I can learn the lesson a million times of like, oh, just do it for 10 minutes and then you'll see it's not so bad. And but I'm always like, I don't want to start it. And then of course, after 10 minutes, I'm like, oh, that was easy. Why didn't I? But it's like Groundhog's Day. Like that happens every single freaking day.
Yeah. And then when you do the task that takes you 15 minutes that you've been like putting off for 15 years.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you want to talk about like New Year's resolutions. Half of them are things I could probably knock out this weekend, you know?
Okay. So what song do you want played when you walk into a room?
I'm going to go with Cause Equals Time by Broken Social Scene.
No clue what
great
that
song.
Is.
It's a great song. I can't hear that song and not want to start playing air guitar. It's so good.
Broken Social Scene, that's the name of the band?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, I look forward to hearing it. Favorite carbohydrate?
I'm a sucker for breakfast is my favorite meal of the day. You could pretty much offer me a pancake or a waffle at any time and I would never say no.
I agree. Cheese.
So if we're talking something I'm going to put on a sandwich, I'm gonna go with like pepper jack.
Okay.
But growing up in the Midwest, felt like I ate my body weight in like queso dip at restaurants. And that's like that. Yeah. Queso, white queso dip. Yeah. That's my favorite. Again,
white liquid
we'll never
cheese,
turn that down.
Baby.
Yeah. Yeah. Inject it directly into my veins.
Condiment, white queso cheese.
I mean, I feel like that would be cheating. I was sad because I think someone just said this recently, but I do love garlic aioli. I was hoping to be original, but I heard that. I was like, yeah, that's a good pick.
We've gotten a handful of garlic aiolis.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that one. I think by volume, probably ranch, but that's so ubiquitous, you know? Yeah. Like, give me like a spicy aioli or like sriracha or something. But yeah, garlic is huge.
Garlic,
for me.
Yeah. Okay, so how did you learn that you were an adult child?
Let's see. So so when you first reached out to ask me for this interview, like you were so smart and anticipating that I'd be like, I don't want to. You're like, don't think about it. Just say yes. And so I did. It was like, I'm fairly new to the shit show and the concept of like being an adult child. Joined ACA about like a year and a half ago, but I was working with a small group of friends on just like art projects, and like I don't really play a lot of video games, but one of them is into that sort of thing. It was like, hey, what if we just like made a little project of making a game just to like learn how to do it, you know? And I agreed to join in, and we were pitching ideas about it. And once I pitched my idea, it's all so low stakes. And they're like, all right, Trevor, like, great, we're gonna go with yours. You're gonna be the project manager, so to speak. It was 10 seconds to go from like, all right, sweet, sounds fun, to being like, no, like this isn't gonna go well. Yeah, this thing that was supposed to be for fun turned into something that I was panicking about after work. Couldn't communicate like what I needed or wanted. Took it too seriously. Basically, kind of took on all of these responsibilities I didn't have to. And then I think a month and a half in, I was like, I can't do this. I gotta go. And so what did I do? I isolated myself and didn't talk to these people for 2 months. And in that time, I was just like, something's wrong here. Like this, it was supposed to be and no pressure. And I immediately went the opposite direction. And I was like, this is something that's kind of been happening my whole life. Like, what's going on? Yeah, it had to do with ADHD, but the feelings were so intense. Like, what do they say? They weren't right size for the situation. It was like, this isn't right. Like, I got to figure this out. So that's when I started looking around, listening to more and more stuff, reading more about ADHD, and then eventually coming across the concept of being an adult child.
What was your understanding of, like, your upbringing? Were you under the impression that you had some baggage or damage from your childhood? up until that point, or was that like something that was hard to come to grips with?
So that this question really trips me up because it requires like conceptualizing, like as a kid, how aware was I of what was going on? The ADHD stuff, those symptoms were really obvious when I turned maybe 9 or 10 and got into like middle school. Up until that point, I was like a fine student, you know? And then there was a day, probably like in the fourth grade, I just never did homework ever again, you know? Like I, by the skin of my teeth, graduated public high school in Kentucky. Like literally the day of graduation, my high school counselor pulled me aside and was like, you can never, ever, ever do this again. But I knew that I struggled with a lot of things that other people didn't, in the sense of just task initiation, like studying, homework, staying on top of things, stuff like that. That was all really obvious to me. I guess I didn't really know where that came from, like how that, what set it up so that I felt helpless when it came to doing those things or unable to change those behaviors. I think like being a latchkey kid probably has something to do with it. So my mom was, and I say was, she used to be a school teacher. She was a kindergarten teacher. So I went to the school she taught at up until the third grade. So there was a lot of structure there. And then when I went to a different school, a lot of that structure sort of fell away. And I think my mom sort of seeing my sister and I as like smart kids, think in the back of her mind, maybe it was like, eh, they got it. They'll be fine. They're bright. They'll figure it out. When it was like, maybe, but we were also still
kids,
children, you know? And so I think I lost a lot of that structure. There was proximity maybe, but not attention. Like my dad was not really invested in like our upbringing in the sense of like day-to-day minutia, homework, school, things like that. That was our mom's arena. And I think she was maybe, we'll just say spread too thin or doing her own thing to really closely observe like how things were going. And so I think I was just kind of left to tread water for a long time. And I just got really, really good at treading water. And then I turned 30 one day and was like, uh-oh, like what happened to my life?
Your parents were married.
Yes. Well, so I grew up with a mother and father, and they got divorced when I was, that must have been 12 or 13. So yeah, it's a fun way to kick off being a teenager, you know, but I'm sure we'll talk more about that.
Well, yeah. So what were the dynamics like between your parents?
Oh, growing up with them, my first actual memory, I think maybe when I was 3 or 4, it must have been after a birthday or something. I just remember waking up from a nap and coming out to our living room and my dad coming home and being like, not recognizing him or just feeling like a sort of like sea change of like, oh, who's this guy? Because he doesn't seem like a lot of fun, you know? General mood between my parents, there wasn't a lot of obvious love or affection between them. Like I could see that very early on. When I say they fought, there were arguments, not like long knockout, drag out fights, but he had a bit of a temper. And so he would raise his voice a lot. And then my mom, I think, did not so great of a job hiding how she really felt about him. You know, I think at a distance, we probably looked like a fine, normal family. But I think my sister and I were just honestly like terrified of our dad at times. And we looked put together when we would go to family functions and things like that. But I think like, neither of us were clamoring to spend more time with our parents from a pretty early age, you know. But 12 or 13, when they finally got a divorce, my mom was pretty nonchalant about telling me about it. But I mean, I just felt relieved because it was like, oh, thank God, this is over. We had gone on a pretty awful family vacation that just, it felt like it was undeniable at that point that like our family was not, we did not want to spend any time with a car in a car with each other. So when they talked about divorce, I was just like, oh, sweet. Like anything is better than what we have going right now.
When you made the comment about your mom didn't do a very good job about hiding how she felt about him, do you mean like kind of like parentification, like using you guys as like therapists?
For me, maybe not parentification. My mom has a sort of talent for maybe not a talent. She can't really give a compliment to save her life. So just any observation she has is tinged with a bit of like criticism, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so just any time she would talk about my dad, like it wasn't in a way where it ever seemed like she was like looking forward to going home and spending time with him, you know? There might be a bit of parentification in there, but just it was pretty early on that it felt like we were taking sides, you mm-hmm. know? And that's where a lot of the confusion came in for me when I think about like trusting my feelings and trusting other people, because it would be, you know, spend a Saturday running errands with my mom and stuff like that. And it felt like every day she was talking shit about my dad, but, you know, it'd be like, all right, it's us versus him. And then we would get home and then she would report back to my dad, like, if I'd misbehaved or something, and then I'd get spanked or something. Mm. And that just felt like total betrayal, you know? Mm-hmm. That probably sounds so dramatic or silly, but it was just hold up now. Like, this guy was public enemy number one, and now you're like, mm-hmm. you're turncoat, man. Like, how could you do this to me? You know? So that really, that was jarring sometimes. It was definitely like whiplash. It just felt like at any minute, it could be like, all right, well, like, am I going to do the one thing that pisses my mom off enough to like sick my dad, the executioner, on me? You know, whatever my mom was going through with my dad, not that she needed to divulge it all to her kids, but it was like, it wasn't acknowledged, you yeah. know? And yeah, it just goes back to the trust thing of like, I couldn't trust my feelings because there was always just the looming threat of wait until your dad comes home, you know? And it was just like, oh my God, like at 5:05 PM, like I'm fucking dead, you know? Mm-hmm. And it could be over who knows what. It's just, it was weird to hear like, you're so smart, like you're gifted, you're the best in your class. And then it's like, also your dad's coming home and he's gonna like kill you, you know?
What was your relationship like with your sister?
As kids, I don't know. I've been thinking about this one recently. So her being 4 years older than me, like developmentally, she wasn't really interested in a lot of the things I was like pretty early on, you know, but like, I think we were kind of siloed off from each other emotionally. I feel like we could only really lean on each other in like really desperate times as like a resistance group or something like that. I don't have a lot of memories of us being particularly warm with each other when we were younger.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I got to be a teenager, I feel like, you know, obviously she's not here to explain herself, but I feel like all of the resentment and anger we felt towards our parents and just failing to create like a safe and sane environment, we just turned that on each other, mm-hmm. you know, just like bitter venom. And we're fine now. I wouldn't say we're particularly close, but it didn't really feel like, or at least I didn't feel like I could be emotionally candid enough to talk to her about things. I think we just both witnessed the same things and maybe made the same parallel choices of just retreating far, mm-hmm. far inward, or just getting away, you know, finding some way to escape.
Did you guys play like pretty different roles in the family? I mean, because it kind of sounds like there was a golden child slash scapegoat going on with you.
Yeah, the role thing is really hard for me to pin down. I was just so in my head as a kid that, like, my sister's definitely more observant than me. She's definitely the achiever in our family. When my parents got divorced, that was around when she was graduating high school. It was kind of sink or swim for her for a while, but then she started a career and she's doing great, whereas I floundered. Like, I think in the divorce, like, my parents both kind of took their eye off the ball, and I just, again, treaded water through school without much monitoring. I don't know if we would call it like learned helplessness, maybe, but it was just like, I wasn't taught a lot of things that a kid should have been taught. And so it was just like,
mm-hmm.
I felt like I had less means to kind of help myself out in that way. Mm-hmm. But I think, again, she's not here to speak for herself, but I think my sister is kind of envious of feeling like my parents loosened up and were less disciplined with me. I can see why that would sting for her, but at the same time, it meant like I had even less structure. You know, mm-hmm. that meant like mm-hmm. I wasn't like developing as much as I should have at the time. You mm-hmm. know?
Mm-hmm.
And then...
So then when your parents got divorced, did he have custody, like partial custody of you guys, or did you spend much time with him?
No, it was pretty unconventional in that I don't know the exact specifics of the arrangement, but my dad didn't have to pay child support. there was a lot of shuffling around between houses. Like, we moved out of our childhood home, and my dad stayed there. And then several years later, he moved out. We moved back in, but there was no shared custody or anything like that, which, like, I think says something. Because at the time, it was never even, like, brought up. But I would have been vocally opposed to spending any amount of time with my dad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There was no shared custody. I saw him. It was actually really frustrating because it was like my mom had all this excitement for not having to deal with my dad anymore, but then would be like, you have to go visit your dad for Thanksgiving. And I was just like, why the fuck do you get to opt out that I have mm-hmm. to go do this, even though mm-hmm. I don't want to? She's like, well, you have to, you know? Yeah, In high school, I saw him maybe 3 or 4 times a year. And then after graduating, I did my best not to talk to him. I went low contact only because it was impossible to go no contact. Yeah, my mom, it was really frustrating in that she would correspond with my dad. Like, they would email and stuff and be like, yeah, Trevor doesn't want to talk to you. But then she would always give my dad my new address or something like that. I would be getting mail no matter where I lived from him, you know? So as much as she was on the same page, she was still, I feel like, sabotaging, like, the mm-hmm. effort to go no contact by just being like, we don't want to talk to you, but if you want to talk to him, like, here's mm-hmm. all of his information. And it was like, Mom, what the fuck are you doing? You know? And I think the last time I saw him was at my sister's wedding. That was going on 10 years ago. And then I think I've gotten a phone call from him a few times, but yeah, I haven't spoken to him. Yeah. In probably a decade.
Did he get remarried?
No. Last time I saw him, I think he might have been dating someone, but besides living in the Midwest, I do not know mm-hmm. how or what he is doing.
Does your sister have any relationship with him?
No, it's the same with her. I think he was invited to the wedding because, you know,
obligation.
He's her father. But like when she had her first child, like we didn't tell him. It was only through gossip that ever got out.
Mm-hmm.
Him. Have that worry of just like, oh, I don't want it to ever be too late. I would hate for him to pass away. And it simply still doesn't feel worth it to me. And I'm not going to beat myself up for feeling that way, you know.
Nor should you.
Speaking. Yeah.
It's also not like a one-way street too.
That's the thing is when my dad would reach out to me, it was sometimes he'd leave voicemails where he was like clearly drunk because he was an alcoholic.
Oh. We forgot to mention that part.
Like, yeah, so I guess it's just assumed, you know? I'm so used to it. It was like the apologies were so rote and so basic that it was like he was tired of apologizing before he had ever really apologized. Yeah.
30s and like coming to terms with the ADHD, was that the first time that you ever sought help? Was that the first time you ever went to therapy or what was your journey with that?
I knew probably as a teenager, like those feelings of depression. In high school, I felt totally helpless. When I was in my mid-20s, I just remember an instance of being somewhere and just feeling like the cloud of depression like roll over me. Like mm-hmm. it was like minute by minute, I could feel it overtaking me. And I remember seeing a therapist, maybe I was 25 or so, seeing a therapist about depression and starting the sort of carousel of treatment of just like, oh, let's try like an SSRI, then let's try something anti-anxiety, low-grade modes of cognitive behavioral therapy, and just feeling like it wasn't really doing anything for me. Repeat that for several years and, you know, self-medicated with weed a lot of the time. And I remember seeing a therapist and talking about ADHD, and she seemed pretty adamant that I didn't that I don't remember what she was countering with when I was like pointing at the evidence, but I just kept pointing to the big hole in my life. It sounds like I'm trying to compliment myself, but it was like so many people when I was younger were just like, you're so smart for your age. You're so adult, which like that's a warning sign mm-hmm. right there. But
mm-hmm.
it was like, everyone's telling me I'm so smart and can do whatever I want. And yet I have nothing to show for it.
Mm.
It shouldn't be this way. You know, like a lot of that depression stemmed from like, there's just a giant hole in the middle of my life. From the outside, it just looked like everyone was having an easier go of it. You know, that's how it felt. I'm not saying that was the truth. So when I moved here to Utah, I resolved to get a handle on ADHD because it just felt like it was a lot of the grief I was experiencing was like based on what felt like a lack of results, you know, of wanting to do all these things and never doing them. And so
I can really relate. Yes.
There is a depression that exists apart from those things. But but at the same time, I feel like it's also very real to feel like a sense of grief for just like an unlived life.
Yeah, I was just about to say that, like, a lack of life lived. Yep.
100%.
Yeah. I enjoyed my 20s plenty, but it was like, there's all these things I'm saying that I want to do and it's not getting done. Mm-hmm. But the nurse practitioner I saw, she had ADHD. I felt comfortable when she was able to clock it pretty quickly. And so that's when I started trying to tackle ADHD and taking it very seriously, which was great at first, but it didn't solve all of my problems, which almost hurt even more at that point to be like, oh, I thought I was safe. Like, no, it's going to be like this forever.
I mean, everyone's pain is valid and this stuff like manifests in so many different ways. There is like a heavy grief and frustration when this stuff manifests in a way that is in an avoidance way, like not the way of like overachieving and perfectionism, but when it manifests in the way of like procrastination and avoidance, like the feeling like the unlived potential, is there's a real heaviness that like I experience with that as well.
That word potential, I think, really messed me up as a kid. I almost wish I had been ignored rather than complimented for things that came naturally so young, because when you get that sort of gifted child status so early, you're like, all right, well, all I have to do is do this for the rest of my life and we're good. I was a 180 in that in middle and high school, as like teachers and people caught on to me just being a slacker, so to speak. I internalized a lot of those voices. And then as an adult, I feel like I have that part that's trying to make up for lost time and prove those people wrong, which has just been so damaging. You know, I'm thankful that it's at least obvious now that it's like those aren't even my ideas. Mm-hmm. But it's another thing to disarm that particular bomb, because I still feel like that's where I get my worth, is like proving like what I'm capable of, you know, which I think compromises a lot of internal family system stuff if you're like going into it like with like a results oriented mindset. That mindset is what probably influences a lot of those ADHD symptoms, in that lately I've been thinking about like the idea of fun. I think this has been spoken about before, but just like the childlike nature and like playfulness. It's not that I hate the idea of fun, but like the word fun has so much too much meaning in it for me, and that like it's hard for me to just let go and have fun. So when I think about art, I think about writing and stuff, I'm just like, I wish I could just write for fun. I'm still working on developing the tools to like exist free of expectation. Because anytime I sit at a table, I'm like, I'm going to do this no matter what it is. I have to do it well. I still can't shake those internal voices, all those things that are saying like, you need to perform. Like you didn't perform, so now it's time you have to. I'm really struggling with that. So with IFS, I think a lot of it is trying to untangle and figure out where those voices are coming from. And how I can like give my system a sense of, you're good. You don't have to impress anybody. You're fine. It is safe to just sit here and take as long as you need or do as poorly as you can manage. You know, like it's fine. It sucks because we're talking about the demons of like aspirational existence, but like I'm about to say, I can't wait to get to the point where that's what I'm doing, you know, like,
oh, I get it. It's like I know,
like a Zen, like Cohen or something like that, like sit on the floor and touch the ceiling with your finger. It's impossible. At the end of the day, I do enjoy IFS because it, for the most part, prevents me from looking to like outside sources of expertise, you know, like I just want someone to tell me what the right thing to do is.
It's
like,
no shit.
No. Yeah. It's like, you have to trust yourself. Like you have to like re-energize that like intuition and gut feeling. Like it can't come from anywhere else but inside.
Have you had any conversations with your mom or your sister about this stuff? About just like your healing?
A little bit with my sister. So my sister works, I'll just say, in like the healthcare industry. Like she continues to go back to school and achieve. And a lot of that has recently involved psychology and psychiatry. And so I think we take different views, different approaches, in that I think she is absolutely more academically minded and comes from it from that perspective. And also just being older than me in general, I know she knows about ACA. I think she has read the Big Red Book without saying too much. I think that kind of scared her off in some sense, which I totally understand. The conversations I have with her, usually it's the same sort of deal where we can talk for a little bit, but I don't feel any better afterwards. It's not that we argue, it's just that her memory supersedes mine. So it ends up feeling like, oh, well, you must be right because you were older at the time or something like that. Or you're smarter. So like,
or maybe correct, you just had two different experiences.
Exactly. And that's what I've come to. That's how I arrived at us being maybe like siloed off from each other. Is that like we just didn't share a common existence, you know, not that either of us are right or wrong. And I've kind of dialed back talking about it a bit just because.
Wasn't helpful.
Yeah, it didn't really provide resolution. If anything, it just kind of riled up, like, my system. I don't know if it did for her. Our mom, my sister, I think, had a really, really brief conversation with her childhood, about my sister's childhood. Basically, a gentle one of saying, like, it wasn't great. And I think even them really seemed to devastate my mom. I think brought up the initial defenses of just denial, you know? My mom and I just, we've never, like when people ask, like, are you close with your family? I'm like, I don't know. My mom and I never, for all the time we spent and lived together, it's like, I have no idea what she's thinking. There's no way she has any idea what I'm thinking, you know? And
do you know much about her upbringing?
Oh, well, I mean, there's some pretty obvious stuff there in that my mom is the middle of 13 kids.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's some really basic stuff there as far as like, you're never going to get enough time with your parent if you're one of 13 children, you know?
No kidding. Jeez.
My father was one of, I think, 5 or 6, you know?
Which is still a ton.
And my maternal grandmother died when my mom was in her 20s. My mom simply didn't spend a lot of time with her mother. Didn't see parenting modeled. I think my mom raised us as if she was raising 13 kids, but there was only two. I recognize my mom did the best she could. It hurts to say that sometimes because it feels like a self-betrayal because I do have those feelings of resentment sometimes, but it's a fact. Like she did the best she could, especially with a husband who was not helping in a broader sense. But just knowing that she didn't get those resources she needed, and my mom has had, she had a brother commit suicide when he was in his 20s. And if you heard my mom talk about it, it's like she's talking about the weather or something. It's like it almost didn't happen to her. I wouldn't go as far as to say it's like a sort of denial, but it's just so casual. It's like, I can't understand it. Seeing the different sort of alliances within all of those siblings and how they all treat each other and go no contact and then gossip about each other. It kind of helps me to understand like my mom's mode of existence in a sense. It's just being 34. I'm interested in understanding the narrative of my life, but I also feel like it's dangerous to try to over narrativize or something because it's as much as I want it to be this to get a happy ending. I just feel like making up a story about yourself and then believing it can be dangerous. I just don't know what I would tell my mom, you know, because I don't know what I would want right now. I'm operating with the belief that she can't change. And so I'm not going to really dwell on what I would want out of that relationship. That might be like self-defeating. The idea of me going to her and saying, hey, just so you know, I felt abandoned from the age of 9 onwards. I just don't imagine that I would get much relief from that. And I don't, just whatever she would say, I don't think it would be enough for me to feel a sense of peace. You helped me out with this once and that, you know, like it is kind of a fantasy to think that one conversation would change everything. But to be honest, being near my mom is usually, there are some like low grade narcissistic tendencies there. And you know, when therapists have been like, oh, what would you say to your mom? It's like, I can't picture it because when I talk to my mom, it's her talking to me for an hour and a half. And then she asks me how things are going at work, you know? So it's hard to conceptualize myself as like a human being first off when I'm around her. So then to bring more agency into it, it's just like, that's a whole lot of work for what I think is just going to be more pain, you know?
If and when we were to have these conversations, it really has to be coming from a place of, I'm saying this because I have to say this for me. I don't give a shit what the response is.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that that's something that we have to do, but it really needs to be coming from a place of, this is something that I need to say for me. I'm not saying that that's what's necessary, but that's really what it needs to be about. I have to say this for me because this is something that I need to say for myself. And whatever they say back really doesn't matter.
You're spot on, because I think that speaks definitely to my situation of, I don't have much to say right now. And, and maybe that'll change, but it's just like...
Or maybe it won't. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's not right or wrong. But
I've kind of traced that back. It would have to be for me. And maybe further down the road, I'll be like, this is what's bugging me. Like,
or
this
maybe
is what
not.
I have to get off,
you know,
my
maybe...
chest. It's the idea, our family is so like placid in some sense of just not really acknowledging things. So like the most violent instance would be, my dad is driving us drunk on vacation and I'm like bursting into tears because it's not, because I don't feel safe. It's like, when I did that and the car got pulled over, like, I just felt guilty. You know what I mean? Like, no one told me it was going to be okay or something like that, or that I hadn't done something wrong. It was like, I was the whistleblower, and there was no sort of conversation after that. And so this sort of feels like an echo of that, in that, oh, I'm going to speak my mind and I'm going to feel guilty and nothing is going to change. I'm not trying to predict the future, but it's...
I think also too, we can say those words and like have those conversations without actually saying it to our parents as well, right? Like in parts work, we can do it through letter writing. It, you know, it also doesn't have to be through an actual conversation as well.
Yeah, letter writing thing. I did one for my father that was helpful for me. And now a lot of it is like, oh, I have this fear of being a bad brother or a bad son. And it's like, you know what? I don't know that that's what they think of me when I don't talk to them often. If it really bothered them, they could tell me. I don't need to internalize. Yeah, it's like, fine, if we need to have these shallow conversations where you tell me what you want for Christmas and I get it for you and we talk for 20 minutes. And that's what's working right now. I don't need to beat myself up about it. I'm happy you asked me to do this because it kind of turns this notion on its head that I have of like recently and starting to date again, like for the longest time.
Oh, let's talk about that.
Oh yeah, we can talk about dating.
Okay, we never got into this. So what has been like, what is your MO? Like, what is your track record there?
Well, okay.
What's your attachment style? Avoidant, I'm assuming.
I would say avoidant. I was thinking about it with like cats this morning, like the metaphor of like in my early 20s, I would act like I really wanted to be in a relationship. It's like when a cat calls at your door at 2 a.m. to get in and then they walk around for 5 minutes and then
they leave
the door to get out.
Yeah.
That's how I was with relationships. Like in my 20s, I would seem like I wanted to date, get into a relationship with a woman, get into it, start to freak out, and then just go totally cold until they were like, all right, you piece of shit. Thanks for wasting my time. You know, women would clock it like, you have so many walls put up, dude. Like, what is your deal? And at the time I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm just me. You know, like, if you didn't say that, but that's in the back of my mind. I was like, I don't see what the big deal is. It took a pretty catastrophic relationship in my mid-20s where I just wasn't an adult, like where I had not developed as far as relating goes. I would drive women crazy by just being so distant, purposefully and then accidentally. So I was saying, like, being here today, it was like, I don't deserve to be on a shit show Saturday. I'm not, like, I'm not far enough along. I'm not healed or whatever. But it's, no, like...
Guess what? We never are.
Yeah, it's like, it like, slaps you right in the face. Like, it's called the shit show. Like, no one's assuming that shit show Trevor is someone who's, like, magna cum laude. So that's really helped me to be like, no, you're never going to be 100% ready or perfect. Like, give
neither
up.
Am I, and I run this
right
shit.
Exactly. And so with dating, it was the same thing of this last time I hopped on the apps, which I loathe, you know.
Fun times. Yeah, tell me about it.
Yeah, my time with the shit show this time around, I'm just gonna be honest about where I'm at with no expectations, like finding the balance of being candid and not being overbearing, of just being like, this is where I am. You know, I mean, that sounds so obvious because I think I was just really afraid when I was younger of just like, oh, if they find out this thing, they're going to see it. They'll see the zipper on my back. I'm just like a monster dressed up as a dude, you know, and it has been awesome so far. This is something that's really casual that every time I'm honest about something, it's like, well, it's not a big deal. Or, oh, me too. Thanks for telling. You know, oh, like, see, Trevor, you don't have to be the best at everything to get love from someone else. That followed me for the longest time. Just those voices that just like, you can't let anyone see the quote unquote ugly human side of you, because if they do, they're not going to like what they see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it turns out that's a crazy way to think.
Yeah. And also very common.
Yeah. 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 I think it's, I don't know, it's
sentiment
so
on the
us.
Ship.
Yeah. We can all treat so many other people kindly, but it's like, once it gets to ourselves, it's like, yeah, but I don't deserve mm-hmm. that sort of kindness. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll get that sort of kindness when I've like fixed.
Mm-hmm.
Everything.
When I'm, yeah, yeah, exactly. When I've arrived.
Yeah.
So how has dating been going?
It's good. We're like 2 months into it, and it's there are bigger talks that need to happen. But I think just as a matter, as an exercise of relating to someone else, it has been so much fun for me. Mm-hmm. And it makes me, it's forcing me to accept compliments and to understand how I regard myself, like body image.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I cannot trust my own brain when it comes to self-appraisal. I'll always be a harsher critic. There's just no getting around that. Or maybe right now there's not. So when other people are like, oh, I like this about you, that natural reflex to be like, no, no.
No, you don't.
Right. It's just like, hey, why am I fighting this? Why am I uncomfortable with this? Why do I have to believe this, like, nasty, mean part of myself and not this kind part of another mm-hmm. person? What's with that? And so this has been really nice, and just being like, okay, you're gonna take a compliment, Trevor, and you're gonna like it, like, enough. So that's honestly been thrilling, because I think part of recovering alone is like, consciously you can want to do it, but if you're doing it by yourself, you're still working from a compromised space, you know. And so it really does take like an outside perspective to like kind of put you on the right path. And and so a lot of me and my natural tendencies to isolate, things like that, like, this has been like awesome in sort of correcting those tendencies to just trust my first and worst opinion of myself. So we'll see how it goes. I didn't think I would be seeing someone at the end of 2025. So it's all new to me. And she has a grasp of ACA and stuff like that. She listened to an audiobook about attachments. So like, that should tell you enough about where she's probably, you know, piloting from. We have a shared language in that sense. So I don't feel like I have to give her a million caveats every time I see her or something like that.
I love it. Okay, well, let's hear three things that you like about yourself.
One thing I like about myself, my tastes. Not that they're great, but they're definitely mine.
I mean, we need shit show merch for that. My tastes. Not that they're great, but they're mine.
What but if they're you mine,
said,
yes.
What if you said my taste buds? Like, you buds. Literally meant your taste buds.
No, I just mean the sense of just like,
I know what you mean.
I do like myself a sense of humor. People who stick around with me mention my sense of humor, and it, I think, used to come from a place of intense self-deprecation, but now we're kind of lightening up in that sense, you know.
Yeah, you can slip into the, my brand is the motivational roasting.
My third thing, I think, is like the sense of integrity of moving on from people pleasing into a sense of justice and fairness that makes sure like nobody's left behind. I made a 2026 bingo card. I've got plenty I could put on there. This year, I want to work on art with no expectations. Let's keep it simple.
Well, awesome. This was great.
Yeah, thank you. This has been an awesome start to 2026 for me. Like, I did not, what a great way to set up a year, you know? I really appreciate it, Andrea.
Oh, I appreciate you.
Yeah, yeah. I regret not speaking more in the interview about the shit show, because, like, as someone new to it, yeah, I don't know. Like, I did ACA here in St. George for a while, but it felt like ACA was like an elective for people in AA. It's nothing against people in AA, but it just felt like it was extra credit, you know? And it just made me uncomfortable at the end of the day. The shit show just like comes so like naturally to me, you know? It's not that I feel like there's a lack of dudes there, but it's just like, there's less guys than women, you know.
Oh, we got solid dudes in there.
We do. We really do.
Some solid dudes.
We're blessed with that. It's like, damn it, like, We need more nerds. Like, shit show nerds, where are you? Come out of the woodwork. Come play a board game with me.
They're all there.
Like, they're there. Yeah, they're around. But yeah, it's been, like, one of the best things in 2025 for me was joining the shit show, for sure.
Mm. Awesome. So this is for you. Yes, you. The person that's been wanting to sign up for Breed to Heal but still hasn't yet. Consider this your aggressive yet loving nudge towards something that's actually going to have a huge impact on the way you show up in the year ahead. And here is why. You will gain practical nervous system tools that you can actually lean on whenever you find yourself feeling dysregulated. The emotional release breathwork sessions will help you release what your body has been holding on to so you actually have some space for the good to come in. Through parts work and compassionate integration, you can get your protectors to calm the hell down so they are not running the show 24/7. Plus, this is 75 minutes each week that you're actually dedicating purely to your own healing journey. And just a reminder, if for some reason you can't make it to a session live, replays will be made available within 24 hours. So we are kicking off next week, January 13th, and we have 4 spots left. So if you are ready to make 2026 the year you actually put your nervous system first, grab your damn spot now. Head to adultchildpodcast.com/breathetoheal. So that is adultchildpodcast.com/breathetoheal. Breathe has an E at the end. Again, consider this your aggressive yet loving nudge.